Chapter 8, Year of the Bean Feed. In late 2005, I told a friend that I was very seriously considering running for the Senate. "Why would you do that?" he asked incredulously. "Well," I said, "I think I could accomplish a lot, and what do I really have to risk?" My friend looked dubious. Public opprobrium? The truth is, no one debating whether or not to run for office is worried about the upside. The problem is the downside. Sure, as an empty nester who had already had a successful career, I was playing with house money. But while the stuff in the pro column was pretty compelling, I was confident I could do a lot of good. It would feel great to beat Coleman, and also, like a lot of people, I kind of really wanted to be a senator. There were a lot of what Donald Rumsfeld charmingly referred to as known unknowns. For example, would I be a good candidate? Did I know enough about the issues? Could I deal with the long hours and the tough questions and the personal attacks and the groveling for money? What if I sucked at it? What if I hated it? What if the voters hated me? What if I lost a race that someone else could have won? What if I was humiliated? What if I had to give a concession speech where I graciously congratulated Norm Coleman on his victory? And what was opprobrium anyway? Most of all was the risk of things going wrong worth the potential good I could do and fun I could have if things went right. There were a lot of questions, and I didn't know the answers, but I told Franny, I don't want not to do the things I'll want to have done if I decide to run. What? Replied Franny. Never mind. You know how we've been talking about moving back to Minnesota and maybe running for the Senate? Yeah. Let's do it. Oh, okay. Sure, if that's what you want to do, honey. As in most marriages, my wife and I have a division of labor when it comes to the day-to-day operations of our household. Basically, it's this. Franny's in charge. I had a vision. I wanted to buy a house near where I grew up in the western suburbs of Minneapolis. Something a little bigger, of course, with a nice big yard. Franny said no, absolutely not. She told me that a house requires constant upkeep and that she'd end up having to do it because I'd be doing the radio show and going all around the state of Minnesota while she had to deal with every plumbing problem or beetle infestation. So instead of a big house with a big yard and bad plumbing and a beetle problem, Franny found us a townhouse very near downtown Minneapolis. Less upkeep, less hassle, and best of all, I could walk to work. We broadcast the show from atop the historic Fauché Tower, which, when I was a boy, was the city's tallest building, smugly thrusting its antenna into the innocent Minneapolis sky. But modern skyscrapers now tower above the once proud Fauché, which cowers meekly among the indifferent glass and steel. I've submitted this paragraph to a middle school writing contest. In my free time, I started laying the foundation for a potential campaign. That meant learning as much as I could about Minnesota issues and getting as much advice as I could from key political players. And it meant showing up everywhere I could to rally DFLers. That means Democratic Farmer Labor Party members, DFLers. That's the Democratic Party in Minnesota, the DFL. So I could rally DFLers across the state for the critical 2006 midterm elections, a sort of dry run for what my own campaign might be like. I also set up a political action committee, a PAC, which would allow me to meet big-shot donors, gauge my fundraising appeal, and build some goodwill by supporting deserving candidates in Minnesota and around the country. Setting up a PAC is a lot easier than it might sound. Basically, you just appoint a treasurer. I pick my high school buddy, Tom Borman. Fill out a four-page form available on the Federal Election Commission's website, and voila, you have a PAC. I named mine Midwest Values PAC, drawn to the clever acronym MVP. Unfortunately, MVP.com already directed to the online store for CBS Sports. Bastards. I thought about just giving up on the whole Senate thing, but no, we would overcome this first hurdle and just buy MidwestValuesPack.org. Not as good, but as I would learn, politics is the art of the possible. Things got easier, mostly because I hired some people who knew what they were doing. Dinah Dale, a soft-spoken Arkansan who had overseen Paul Wellstone's fundraising operation, was in charge of connecting me with wealthy progressives who might be interested in contributing to my PAC. Dinah brought in another Wellstone alum, A.J. Goodman, a lawyer who had defended murderers and drug dealers in Miami before she turned to the more high-stakes, cutthroat world of political fundraising to set up MVP events around the country. We also started a direct mail fundraising program. Turns out the number one determinant of whether someone gives money in response to a mail solicitation is whether or not they open the envelope. And because I had something of a following for my books and radio show, instead of just tossing my envelopes into their trash cans, or if they were environmentally conscious, their recycling bins, people tended to open them. Inside, they'd find a letter that didn't sound exactly like every other fundraising letter they were getting. Mine began, "Dear person, I'm asking for money." Moderately amused liberals from coast to coast sent in contributions. Midwest Values PAC was off and running. The money we raised wasn't for me. The point was to give it away to progressive candidates and causes in Minnesota and around the country, and for me to get credit for it. Smart, huh? Next step, coffee. A lot of politics gets done over coffee. That's true all over the country, but especially in Minnesota. Minnesotans just love coffee. My first coffee was with my friend Jeff Blodgett. Jeff had been the campaign manager for all of Paul Wellstone's Senate campaigns. As fiery and passionate as Paul was, Jeff is calm and measured. Jeff kind of looks like a prototypical Minnesota guy. Trim, clean-cut, the kind of man who spends 30 years of his life looking like he's 45 years old. Jeff is reserved but intense, also not funny. He gave me lots of sound advice about where I should go and with whom I should meet. But the one piece of advice that I remember most vividly was Jeff's suggestion that, as an exercise, I write a 5-minute speech without any jokes in it. Why, I thought, would anyone want to do that? I was a comedian. All the validation I had received in my career had been for making people laugh, even if I was talking about something serious. Clearly, I had a lot of learning to do. I was insanely busy. There was a 3-hour daily radio show for which I stubbornly insisted on actually preparing every night. There was national travel, where I'd take the show on the road in conjunction with book signings and promotional appearances for our local affiliates. There was fundraising for MVP. There was a lot of coffee. And, of course, there was traveling around Minnesota, which brings me to bean feeds. Bean feeds are essentially the organizing medium of DFL politics. They are exactly what they sound like. People show up, maybe make a small donation to the local chapter of the party. They eat, and there's a speaking program. To be clear, not every bean feed is literally a bean feed. There are burger bashes, spaghetti dinners, corn feeds, and walleye fries. But the classic bean feed, for example, the one in Canada-Yohai County, is the best. It's basically a potluck with tables filled with assorted bean dishes, baked beans, bean salad, chili with beans, and other bean dishes. And now a few words about farting. Thanks to Lord Byron's famous musical fruit poem, when you bring up beans, most people think of flatulence. And if you've never been to a bean feed, you probably imagine that the speaking program that follows the meal would be punctuated by loud, outboard motorish farts, as well as a pungent aroma. Well, you're wrong. While a skeptical senior might occasionally fart loudly to indicate disapproval of something specific that was said, or of the speaker in general, in my experience, this is always done deliberately and sparingly. And because bean gas is largely produced by cellulose and not by decayed animal matter, the odor of bean feed farts is generally inoffensive to the point of being virtually undetectable. Why go to all these bean feeds? Well, not just for the food. Minnesota has a caucus system. through which the DFL and Republican parties endorse candidates for office. The folks at the bean feeds are the people who participate in the caucuses, get elected as delegates to the state convention, and decide who gets their party's endorsement. The upshot of all that is that if you want to serve Minnesota in the United States Senate, you start by going to a lot of bean feeds. Of course, I wasn't running for the Senate in 2006. Amy Klobuchar, now our senior senator, was. And thank goodness, because I learned a lot about how to run for the Senate by watching Amy. No human being works harder than Amy Klobuchar. If Amy wasn't at a bean feed I went to, then her husband John Bessler and their daughter Abigail were there. If John and Abigail weren't there, Amy's father, Jim Klobuchar, the beloved Minneapolis Star Tribune columnist, was there. If none of them were there, I wondered, why am I here? Following Amy's example, I tried to show up everywhere I was invited. Fortunately, I had plenty of invitations, and because I wasn't actually running, I felt free to ignore Jeff Blodgett's advice and mix in a healthy dose of the funny. I was having fun, eating a lot of beans, drinking a lot of coffee, and discovering something about myself, which is that while I may not have been blessed with a lot of natural political talent, one thing I did have going for me is that I really like people. Now, I was 55 years old, so I kind of knew that about myself already. But I didn't realize that being an extrovert actually counted as a skill when it came to politics. For a lot of people who run for office, constantly having to talk to people is exhausting. For me, it's energizing. I really like learning about people's lives. I really like hearing their stories. I really like meeting their kids. And because it was clear that I was really enjoying getting to know these folks, they really enjoyed getting to know me, and they were maybe just a little bit pleasantly surprised about that. You see, Minnesotans are skeptical of people in show business, as well they should be. And because I'd been on TV, some folks made weird assumptions about me. For example, that I had a trophy wife who was 20 years younger than me. Well, I did have a trophy wife, Franny, who's almost a full 5 months younger than me. If the fact that I was friendly and approachable challenged people's assumptions, meeting Franny blew them away. Early on, we went to a bean feed in Minneapolis, and Franny decided to bake and bring an apple pie. When we arrived, the organizer looked at this gorgeous, massive pie and said, "Oh my, let's make this an item for the silent auction." The pie got $75. Word got around about Franny's pies. Lori Sellner, the DFL chair for Southern Minnesota, bought one for $100 at a bean feed at the Jackpot Junction Casino near Redwood Falls. The next time I saw Lori, she raved and raved about Franny's pie. Having once been in show business, I decided to make a thing out of it. At every event in Lori's district, I'd auction the pie immediately following a short bit of shtick with Lori. "So, Lori, you bought this pie at the bean feed at Jackpot Junction, is that right?" "Yeah." "And how was it?" "Oh, unbelievably good. The most delicious apple pie I've ever had." "Uh-huh. And this is a big pie, right?" "Oh, yeah." "How many people did this pie feed?" 18. 18 people. "And were those were big pieces?" "Oh, yeah, yeah." "Now, Lori, I understand you're not a crust person." "No, I'm not. I normally don't like the crust that much. But tell me about this crust." "Well, it was light and flaky and delicious. I couldn't get enough of this crust." Then I'd auction the pie. It was not unusual to raise $200, $300, which could help get a lot of voters out to the polls in local races where a few votes can make all the difference. Now, Franny baked well over 100 pies over the next couple of years for volunteers, for state legislators, even for Walter Mondale. During a crowded bean feed in Princeton, Minnesota, I watched a guy in his 60s pointing to Franny and asking a friend, "Who's that?" "That's the pie lady." "Oh, the pie lady." If 2006 was a test run for a potential campaign, the results couldn't have been more encouraging. We raised more than $1 million for Midwest Values PAC and helped elect dozens of candidates in Minnesota and around the country. DFLers across the state kept telling me they hoped I would run, and the crowds that showed up at the bean feeds made me feel like I'd have plenty of support if I did. So not only did running feel like it might be a lot of fun, it felt like I might just have a good chance of pulling it off. And more importantly, the more time I spent talking with Minnesotans, the more I wanted to be their senator. All year, as I met with teachers and nurses and farmers and folks from all walks of life, I appreciated how decent, hardworking, loving, innovative, and compassionate they were. And as I did, I couldn't help but get excited at the prospect of working for them in Washington. The idea of running had become less and less about beating Norm Coleman and more about improving people's lives. As Democrats celebrated their big win in November 2006, it was time for me to make a final decision about running. If I was going to beat an incumbent, I'd have to start early. Franny was all in, but of course, we wanted the kids to have a say. "Everyone has a veto," I announced at Thanksgiving dinner. We discussed the pros and cons. Joe expressed some qualms about the time I'd be away from the family, especially if I won. "What do you want me to do?" I asked. "Give speeches for a lot of money and write a book now and then?" "That sounds pretty good," Joe said, only half kidding. But both kids were on board. I think they could see how badly I wanted to do it. "Okay," Thomason said, "but if you have something to tell us now." Essentially, my daughter was saying, "I'm all for this unless you've done something horrible that we don't want to know about." But aside from the chainsaw massacre Franny and I had participated in years ago on the way to a Satanist orgy, we were clean. So, I had everyone's blessing. Now it was just up to me. Did I really want to do this? Did I really want to spend every minute of my life making phone calls to raise money, running around the country to raise money, and running around the state to raise money? And what about that public opprobrium thing my friend in New York had mentioned? The time had come to look up opprobrium in the dictionary. Trembling with anxiety, I went to the family dictionary on our dictionary stand and thumbed to the O's. Opprobrium, I read. Harsh criticism or censure. Oh, was that all? I could handle that. After all, I had written Stuart Saves His Family and produced SNL during the Anthony Michael Hall season. I had nothing to fear from public scorn. I gave myself till the new year to make the final call. In the meantime, as I had done the three previous Christmases, I went with the Sergeant Major of the Army's USO tour to Kuwait, Iraq, and Afghanistan for 2 weeks. It seemed like as good a place as any to do a gut check. Many of the troops we met that year were on their third, fourth, or fifth tour of duty, and had served in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Confirming the reports we'd heard back home, many told us that neither war was going well. The toll on our troops was mounting. More than 3,000 of our men and women had been killed in action in Iraq and Afghanistan. Of those who came home, many were returning with limbs missing and suffering from traumatic brain injury, the signature wound of the post-9/11 wars. The emotional wounds were mounting, too. The chances of post-traumatic stress rose exponentially with each deployment. But we learned that more than explosive devices, more than bullets, more than anything else, what our troops feared was a Dear John letter, something they probably had in common with military men from previous wars, though now a Dear Jane letter was also a possibility. On some bases, soldiers taped their letters up on a wall of heartache. This was our fourth year of shows with the Sergeant Major of the Army. The first year, our show was 2.5 hours, which we worried was too long. It wasn't. The second year was 3 hours. The third year, 3.5 hours. That fourth year, we did a 4-hour show. And they loved every minute of it. Even if, like at the show at Camp Phoenix in Kabul, it meant standing in 29-degree cold for 4 long hours. At the end of each show, the Army band played a number of tunes that we all sang along to, God Bless America, Stand By Me, and a Toby Keith song, American Soldier. "Oh, I don't want to die for you, but if dying's asked of me, I'll bear that cross with honor, 'cause freedom don't come free." I will never, ever forget the feeling I had singing that song, watching our servicemen and women swaying back and forth, arm in arm, belting out those words and meaning them with every fiber of their being. It made me feel a little silly for being so worried about the long days or the nights not spent sleeping in my own bed or the nasty attacks on my character that would come with running for the Senate. If you replace the word die in the song with be insulted personally, you'll note that it loses much of its power. From that day forth, I resolved I would never complain about any of the inconveniences or indignities that might come with running for office. No, that's not true. I complained a lot. I still complain. A lot of this book, in fact, is me complaining. But hell, I felt like I could do some good. And spending 2 weeks with all these men and women who were risking far more than I would ever have to risk made me even more motivated to do as much good as I could, even if it would never compare to the sacrifices they were making for me and my fellow Americans. As it turned out, it was actually a pretty easy decision. I was going to run.